It's good to see everybody. All right, so this morning I'm going to continue to talk about Enmo, Suchness, a Fascicle by Dogen. And here's the paragraph I want to talk about. My body is not I. My life is carried along by the years and months, hard to stop even for a moment. Where have those rosy cheeks gone? When we search for them, there are no traces of them. When we look carefully, there are many things in the past that we will never meet again. The bare mind also does not stand still, but comes and goes in pieces. Though there may be truth in it, it is not something that lingers in the vicinity of the self. So, do a little deconstructing of this passage. Dogen starts out and he says, my body is not I. So, we don't really have any absolute control over our body. In fact, the I that we relate to as a self, it's not different from the body, right? So we like to say, so when he says, my body is not I, he's not saying to us, our body and this sense of I are two separate things. He's saying that this body and this I are the same thing. And this, they are not different from each other, but that the I that we associate as self is one particularity in the totality of all of reality functioning. You've heard this before, right? Patty said to me during our class, our Uji class, she said something like, I feel like we're just hearing the same thing over and over again. She says, no, that's not really what I said. What I said was, what she said was something like, I feel like Dogen's message is the same thing. And we're talking about variations on that message. And my response to her was, yes, because Dogen does have a reoccurring message, but we're also only talking about one fascicle, which was Uji, and we've talked about it a lot. So, but I didn't add, but thought to myself, I also have a certain way of understanding this and talking about this. So you're getting it from me, right? And so like Jaku has a different way of talking about self, same thing, but a really different way. So it behooves you to know that also as well. Anyway, to go back to this, you know, my body is not I. And so this is about this fact that this I is not ours alone, that it is one particularity within this totality of the world's functioning. So this body is a no self. In other words, as I've said before, this body is a no inherently existing body. This body, this self, this mind is constantly changing, right? We're constantly in an impermanence. So we don't have any self that's separate from the body, nor do we have a self that's separate from the totality of all of this functioning that's going on around us. It is, you know, contingent upon that activity. So all of this is happening together. And yet, of course, we do have a self, we have a personality, we have individuality. So what this means is that in Buddhism is that it's really important that we understand that the self and the world are not different, that we are not somehow completely separated from that. And this universal aspect of who we are in our relationships and how we understand the nature of our functioning is the self that drops itself. When Dogen says dropping the self, dropping body, mind, that's what he's talking about. He's saying, you know, don't get caught in this sense of just, I am a separate little island. And out of this, I am not a separate little island. Out of this is what arises is compassion and empathy. We could not have compassion and empathy without recognizing that we are not a little island. Because if we were totally separate from everybody else, how would we have empathy with anybody else? Because we wouldn't have any notion of what anybody else was thinking or doing or being. You know, if we go to therapy, one of the things about going to therapy is thank goodness that we're all alike. Because if we weren't alike, a therapist would have nothing to say to us because there would be no structure in which to address the neuroses that we have as human beings or the problems that we have. So we have this shared reality, and out of this connection comes compassion and empathy. So what we're really engaged in is this one event arising and falling. Just what we experience is just this life. So just this life is just this life, that life, your life, our lives, and the whole of the world's life. And this is practice. So we really are a family. And at the same time, we deeply feel our own singularity, our own life, and our own suffering and joy. Okay, so my body is not I. But then he goes on, my life is carried along by the years and months. Hard to stop even for a moment. Can we stop even for a moment? Stop time? Stop our life? Where have those rosy cheeks gone? I like that. Where have those rosy cheeks gone? When we search for them, there are no traces of them. When we look carefully, there are many things in the past that we will never meet again. There are many things in the past that we will never meet again. So we can't stop time passing. And our bodies, we can't stop that transformation even for a moment. You know, that's kind of scary to think about. So our life just keeps marching towards our death, right? That's one way we can think about it. But there's other ways that we can think about this as well, because that's kind of a dark vision, don't you think? Depending on how you relate to that. But the other thing we can think about is, which I think is what Dogen's point is, his point is that each moment counts. Each moment is an encouragement for us to do our practice, to be our best person. Each moment, we get to, like, if we mess up in this moment, there's the next moment. So there's always the next moment for us to change, transform, encouraging us each moment to be our best person. So looking at this part where he says, no traces of them remain, these rosy cheeks. I think about that, and I thought, well, you know, at my age, when I do think about my youth, I realize that there were parts that were, you know, great, parts that weren't so great. And to be honest with you, there are lots and lots and lots and lots and lots and lots that I don't remember at all, right? I remember far less than actually happened in the course of my life. So we do have a trace, right? We do have these traces, this karma, and we can look back and appreciate our youth. And if you're younger and you're in this audience, although I don't see many of us who are too young, just to say, please enjoy your life. Don't give yourself a hard time, because as I look back on my life, there are things I gave myself a really hard time about when I was 20 or 30, and really I should have just been enjoying myself, you know. So anyway, that's my little bit of looking back advice. But, you know, in a funny and a paradoxical way, we have all the time in the world, and we have no time at all. So again, when we search for them, there are no traces of them. So again, I'd say it's not entirely true. We have memories, lasting relationships. So there are these traces. So then he says, you know, these no traces of our rosy cheeks. And then I would still say, when I think about this, I'd say, well, you know, there could be, I mean, there kind of are. It's like we have memories and places that are deeply significant in our lives that we feel like have still carried forward and informed our lives, maybe in a negative way, positive ways. But, you know, I think maybe what Dogen's just saying here is something really simple, is that when you look in the mirror, you're not seeing your seven-year-old self when you look in the mirror. There may, you know, there may be like, I don't even remember what I looked like when I was seven. Do you? I mean, I have pictures, but when I look in the mirror, I don't remember. I don't ever recall a time that I looked in the mirror when I was 7 years old and saw, and, you know. So anyway, he says, you know, there are no traces of these rosy cheeks. So time is passing. Time is going on. And I think that's what Dogen's saying. We need to be aware of, make an observation to ourselves and remember that time continues on, and then our life and our body and our minds and ourself, that too continues on, constantly changing. And so, as we know, this is impermanence, and Buddhism talks about impermanence a lot. So maybe he means that this section in some ways is an acknowledgement of our wisdom, an acknowledgement of our acceptance of this impermanence. That this is the Dharma's truth of impermanence. That our self is not just ours. As a matter of fact, there's no possession that we have that's a singular thing called the self. And that our life is fleeting, as all of our lives are. So here's, I'd say, might be the big takeaway from this section of the Inmo. One, don't waste time. Make your best effort and practice. And two, acknowledge that we can't afford to be caught in the delusion of thinking we have a self in such a way that we are selfish about it. Okay, we have a self, but that this is not, we are not a singular self detached from the totality of all of our relationships that are known and unknown. Okay, so that's that. It's not actually that, but for now. So the next line is the bare mind. So the bare mind means your sincere mind. That's what that phrase means. So if you read that in a Chinese or in a Buddhist text, it means sincerely, your sincere awakened mind. So this bare mind, he said, also does not stand still, but comes and goes in pieces. Okay, the comes and goes in pieces means that it's expressed moment to moment. Because there's no other way that we can express this, right? We can only express our practice as this moment is arising. We can't express it, can't go back, and we're not in the free future, just this moment, the eternal now. We express this. So he says, the bare mind also does not stand still, but comes and goes in pieces. Though there may be truth in it, it is not something that lingers in the vicinity of the self. So there may be truth in this bare mind that does not stand still, but comes and goes in pieces. There may be truth in it, but this truth is not something that lingers in the vicinity of the self. So again, this is going back to when he says, my body is not I. So he's pointing to this universal aspect of the self. So we are connected. We're part of larger events, a larger event that's not just our own body and mind. We're more than our perceptions. We're more than our genetic upbringing. We're more than our family, our immediate family. So this awakened or bare mind is fluid. What we're striving for is a fluid mind, a mind in which what is happening is not just in our heads. It's not just a narrow perception of what's going on, but that it is inclusive of the totality of our experience. So It's a response to the whole of our life, as a citizen, if you will, a citizen of our circumstances and events that we are experiencing in this moment. And because those conditions are constantly in flux, because they are impermanent, then our responses must be nimble. And out of this nimbleness is our wisdom. This wisdom of interbeing and impermanence. And this wisdom and this response of the bare mind comes and goes in pieces. In other words, it's expressed in this moment and this moment and this moment and this moment. So that means that our awakened bare mind is constantly asking us to be awake, to be attentive and aware of who we are and what is it that's actually happening. So that's why he says, there may be truth in it. So he's saying there may be truth that resides in this body mind, but at its essence, it is not something that lingers in the vicinity of the self. This wisdom is not something that lingers in the vicinity of the self. This wisdom, or as I like to say, our skillful response, has to be something larger than ourselves. In fact, if we don't include the whole of each interaction, it's not going to be skillful. Now, sometimes we're doing our best, but we can't see it because of our own delusion. But this is our practice, right? To strive, to engage in this. So all of us have developed kind of ways of being. Some of them are very good ways of interacting that can be helpful, and some of them are not particularly helpful at all. Or some of them are helpful sometimes, but not helpful other times. Some of them are never helpful. Some of them are always helpful. So that's why we have so many self-help books, right? That's why we have so many of these books on how to process. And what I mean in the sense of is like, how do you be your best self at work? How do you be a good boss? How do you listen skillfully? How do you be a good parent? How do you be a good friend? You know, it's like there's a book out there. There's a workshop out there. But I think a key element of all of this is they all include the other. Every one of these things is somehow about including other and about putting ourselves in the other person's shoe as a way to develop skillful means. So what this means is that we have to let go of our own agenda and try to expand our perceptions, our mental concepts, to include this totality of our actions as they affect others, and adjust accordingly. Pay attention, see it, adjust. So for example, Putin has an idea right now. He has a concept about how Ukraine is part of Russia. And that concept is deeply embedded in his own sense of self, that he is Russia, that Ukraine is Russia, that all of this is about me, right? And so it's deeply embedded in there. And for him, Ukraine is part of himself. And consequently, he isn't very good at this practice that Dogen is talking about. Right? That's like a big understatement. Okay, so first, there may have been a time in which Ukraine was part of Russia, but those rosy cheeks are gone. The traces that remain are no longer part of the pieces and the moment to moment of reality's passage. Because he cannot open up to the totality of all the players that are involved in this situation, he is caught in a self that is completely disconnected from wisdom, completely disconnected. And he's creating untold suffering. So this is where Dogen is calling our bare mind for Putin is hidden. He cannot access his bare mind, and he cannot access it at this time. But of course, it's there. because that's part of our teaching. Our teaching is that all beings are Buddha nature. So there's, he is Buddha nature, but he cannot access it. So now Dogen goes on. So that was my kind of rift on this, but Dogen goes on in a more positive vein in the text. And he says, such, remember, talking about such is a shorthand for suchness or thusness or things as they are. Such being the case, there are those who, for no apparent reason, bring forth the mind of a Buddha, bring forth the mind of Bodhi. Once this mind arises, casting aside what we've previously enjoyed, we aspire to hear what we have not yet heard and seek to verify what we have not yet verified. So he says, this is not entirely of our own doing. We should realize that this is so because we are such a person. How do we know we are such a person? It is because we wish to get such a thing that we know we are such a person. Okay, so he says, because suchness or such, in this case, Inmo, Buddha nature, he says it's a cooperative unfolding of life as one event, which includes all particular beings, events, things, etc. So this participation is suchness itself, and it is, as such, our life. The activity is bright, because this is how we understand suchness, Buddha nature. It is at its essence, its bare mind. It is bright, and it is luminous, and it is altruistic. So there are people who become aware of this activity and want to dedicate their lives to incorporating themselves into life in a good way, in a helpful way, right? I would say that's true for everyone here. That's true for everyone online. That's true for many bazillions of people in the world. They want to do this, to engage in this activity. They want to know how to do this. Again, why do we have so many self-help books? Because we've got a lot of people who want to know how to do this. And there are many different ways to do this, but this we're doing this way in Soto Zen. And in particular, we're listening to what Dogen has to say about this. So we want to dedicate our lives to this. Such being the case, there are those, for no apparent reason, who bring forth the mind of Bodhi. So I thought this line, for no apparent reason, is kind of interesting, the phrase, for no apparent reason. This awakening happening. So what do you think? Does this happen? Does it happen for no apparent reason? Do you know why you aspire to practice? Do you know what awakened you to feeling this connection with your larger life, with this world? Can we just leave it, you know, without exploring it any further to say, no apparent reason? So as I look at this, I say, I think the key word here is apparent. Is apparent. It's not clear. And it isn't clear. We don't know exactly why it is, but it is. And it is suchness, are such a person. So this is what we say is this essence, this essential nature. So because this is this totality, this holographic event, we might pick on some little piece of it, but it, in and of itself, in some ways it's hidden. The specificity of it is hidden. But so it isn't surprising that we wake up for no apparent reason, because it's, in some ways, it's hidden. And when I say it's hidden, I mean, we can't see the complete ramifications and totality of all of this playing itself out. So now I think Dogen does a classic Dogen circular logic thing here. And the next section, he says, Once this mind arises, casting aside what we have previously enjoyed, we aspire to hear what we have not yet heard and seek to verify what we have not yet verified. This is not entirely of our own doing. So I'll say something about that in a minute. But here's the circular logic that I really love. We should realize that this is so because we are such a person. How do we know that we are such a person? It is because we wish to get such a thing and that we know. Therefore, we know that we are such a person. So it's like saying, you know, he says, because you are, let's say, Buddha nature instead of such a person, we should realize this is so because we are Buddha nature. How do we know that we are Buddha nature? It is because we wish to understand Buddha nature that we know we are Buddha nature. So it's a, you know, you are Buddha nature, you understand that you're Buddha nature, you know you're Buddha nature because you want to know about Buddha nature. Isn't that obvious? So that's that motivation, that's that no apparent reason. So then there are some other things aside here. He says, okay, once we realize that we are endowed with a Buddha mind, Bodhi mind, we cast aside what we have previously enjoyed. So I thought that was interesting. We cast aside what we previously enjoyed. Does that mean no more murder mysteries? But you know, what exactly does that mean? No more chocolate cake, no more, you know, I'm not sure what, but no more of those kind of frivolous activities that we don't associate with practice, you know. But I think what he's saying here is that we have in the past enjoyed the sense of being separate, of having a certain kind of sense of having a false autonomy, thinking that we are accountable to no one, that this is freedom, that we have this sense of abandoned freedom. We can say anything, we can do anything, and that we think that this is freedom. But from a Buddhist perspective, this life is, that kind of life is actually a life of suffering. We suffer ourselves and we cause suffering to others. And essentially, this is a lonely life of isolation that we're cutting ourselves off from this vibrant totality that's functioning, which, of course, we can't not be part of anyway. So Dogen says, you know, we let it go and we aspire to hear what we have not yet heard and seek to verify what we have not yet verified. And this is not entirely of our own doing. So, you know, this activity of letting go is really hard. It's really hard to do this letting go of the self, or as Dogen says, dropping body and mind. And that means that we let go of the selfish aspect of our personality that doesn't want to acknowledge its responsibility to others. So, for example, we don't want to apologize when we know that we've done something that, because we feel like it diminishes our sense of self. We don't want to be wrong. We don't want to be inconvenienced. We don't want to feel trapped or disturbed. You know, we want what we want. And we want it our way, come hell or high water. And that mindset that we can fall into, you know, that letting go of that is just not easy to do. But doing that, to let it go, helps change our attitude and adjust our understanding of our relationship between the self and the other. And when we do that, one of the ways that we do that is that we try to find a methodology, if you will, a path. We look for a community and we want support along this journey. So that brings us to this last part. This is not entirely of our own doing. This is not entirely of our own doing. So in Uji being time, Dogen said that our effort is supported by and in concert with all the devas and other beings manifesting to our left and right. So we can't see them, but they are helping us. You can think of this, you know, we're constantly talking about Buddhist ancestors. in our formal practice. The Buddhas and ancestors are to the left and the right of us. Jaku was saying recently, she said, you know, so I often think of myself as being at the end of the line, but actually we're not at the end of the line, as she's pointed out. We're in the middle of the line, or the first third of the line, or wherever we are in that line, but we are part of this continuum, you know, of beings, and not just people, but beings, all beings making this effort, and they are supporting us. So they're helping us. So you can think about that, you know, when you call forth the Buddhas and ancestors, like, hey, buddies, come stand next to me. We are comrades, you know, in this endeavor and this activity that we're engaged in. And not only are we comrades, but we're also part of a succession of helpers, right? So they are our Sangha, they are our inspiration, and they are our cheering squad. Furthermore, as we do this practice, we're helping others as well. And although we may not see that, and they may not see it, it is still happening. The world itself is like a mutual benefit society. So we might not see this. It may not be apparent to us. But in Buddhism, we believe this to be true. And that is our faith. So in Japanese Buddhism, there are two phrases. One is called self-effort, jiriki, which means literally one's own strength, and other effort, tariki, which means other power or outside help. Both of these activities are critical for our awakening. We make effort, others make effort. The Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and ordinary folks make effort on our behalf, as we do for them. Our effort becomes others' effort, and others' effort become our effort. And still, it is not apparent to us, but this is going on. So becoming consciously aware of cooperative reciprocity is quite important in our practice. It motivates us to go further, to investigate, to enact our lives on the Bodhisattva path. So right now in this world, and I would say this has always been true, but in our time right now, I think we feel this particularly. Right now, there is nothing more important than each one of us in our own way, not a made up way, but in the ways that we can actually do what we can do as individuals, as a group. It's important that we find our path in this way, and we find the truth of this path in the teachings, and that we walk this path. So as Dogen said at the beginning of the Inmo, he said, if you want to get such a thing, you should be such a person. Since you are such a person, why worry about such a thing? Thank you.